May it please the court, counsel, Kyle Davenport, bar number 36674, on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Gary Dolaw. Your honors, the issue we are here today to decide is whether payment of stock and cash to John Ellerton upon the occurrence of a specific event is an exempt retirement plan, pretty much solely because it's referred to as a retirement plan by Mr. Ellerton as his employer, Sefton Resources. Plaintiff appellant Gary Dolaw position is that the answer to that issue is no, and requests that this court reverse the trial court and remand for further collection proceedings on this retirement obligation. If the court recalls what this obligation specifically is, is John Ellerton is the president of a company called Sefton Resources. And a month after Mr. Dolaw made demand for repayment of over $400,000 in loans, Mr. Ellerton entered into an employment agreement with Sefton Resources. And as part of that agreement, it provided that he was to receive what is referred to in that agreement as a retirement obligation. That's been modified slightly through the course of time, but as it stands now, that obligation is a payment. If Mr. Ellerton is to stay as the president of Sefton until some alternative financing is obtained, he is to receive over $800,000 in stock in Sefton Resource and $300,000 in cash. Cash may be reduced by some amounts he may owe back to Sefton Resources. But in any event, he's at least able to receive over $800,000 worth of stock in Sefton Resources. His argument, pretty much.
Does he have to leave the employ of Sefton Resources?
Your Honor, that's not entirely clear. The original employment agreement provides that you did not receive the retirement obligation until he terminates his employment relationship. But the annual report simply says that he is to receive this payment when he turns 65. Later on, Mr. Ellerton testified in a Rule 69E examination, but that has been modified slightly again, and as long as he stays the president until alternative financing is obtained, then he will get this payment of stock and cash.
Whether he then terminates his employment or not?
That's unclear. The original employment agreement does state that he must leave the employ to get this payment, but those modifications in the annual report stating what the agreement is and then Mr. Ellerton's testimony doesn't say anything about him leaving his employ. So it is possible, we believe, that he does not require to leave the employ of Sefton Resources to not be the president anymore to get this retirement obligation.
Why aren't, recognizing the lower court's order was very brief, I mean, why aren't these factual issues that implicitly, if not explicitly, the lower court resolved adverse to you and your client?
Your Honor, they are, and I think Your Honor is referring to the fact that he may be required to leave and it's referred to a retirement obligation.
The sense of my question was, whatever a retirement obligation involves raises some factual questions. What you seem to have been spending the last few minutes arguing are the facts. Typically, we don't go behind a lower court's decision on a factual matter. So I guess I'm clear. Are you saying that there are facts here that as to which, you know, no reasonable judge could have decided against you, or is there some legal issue here that overcomes the adverse factual determination?
Your Honor, there is a legal issue here that overcomes the factual determination. Whether or not
that is what?
Whether or not Mr. Ellerton is required to leave his employ or not. What this really is just simply a payment to him.
Why isn't that a factual issue as to which you may have very persuasive arguments, but you lost before the lower court?
It's not a factual issue, Your Honor, because of the way it relates to the specific exemption statute. The specific exemption statute states that a retirement obligation is exempt, including, and it goes on to state specific tax exempt and ERISA, or tax qualified and ERISA qualified plans. Our argument is that this specific, I'll refer to as a retirement obligation, does not fit within the retirement plans that are exempted in that statute.
Because it's not tax or ERISA qualified.
Because it's not tax, and that's not in dispute. It's not tax or ERISA qualified, and admittedly, the statute may be broader than just only tax and ERISA qualified plans.
The statute is broader, then doesn't that take us back to my earlier question, which is the trial court expressly or at least impliedly resolved those factual issues against you?
The trial court found, it did not, the trial court, I don't believe, made any real factual distinctions. The facts were what they were, and the trial court found that this retirement obligation was exempt under the statute.
And even though there's undisputed evidence that it was not tax or ERISA qualified, doesn't that compel the conclusion that the trial court adopted a broader definition of the phrase retirement plan in the statute than tax qualified?
The trial court did adopt a broader definition, but the definition as a legal matter is not as broad as what the trial court adopted.
Where's the limits? If it's not just tax qualified or ERISA, then where that broader definition, what's the limit of it?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's the issue here. The limits are it must share at least some of the characteristics of those ERISA qualified and tax qualified retirement plans.
What would those characteristics be?
Those characteristics would be some management requirements as comparable to ERISA and tax qualified plans. Some specific tax benefits as opposed to this just simply being treated as income. Reporting requirements.
Is that tax qualified in another name?
I'm sorry, no.
When you say having tax benefits, is that tax qualified under another rubric? How would it have tax benefits without being tax qualified?
Well, it would need to have, as if you're comparing a tax qualified plan to this payment in this case, tax qualified plans have specific tax benefits associated with them, IRAs, Roth IRAs, etc. This plan, this retirement obligation, doesn't have any of those similar tax benefits.
What tax benefits could there be without it being a tax qualified plan?
Your Honor, that's not an answer I don't believe that I can answer directly today.
I'm not sure we can if we don't get some help is part of the issue.
Let me try it this way, if I could maybe try to recast Judge Deegan's question. One interpretation of the statute would be that a retirement plan has to be tax or ERISA qualified, correct?
I think that could be an interpretation.
Are you arguing that interpretation?
No.
Okay. If you're not arguing that interpretation, then what exactly is it that a retirement plan must include, which is not also embraced within the concept of tax or ERISA qualified?
I don't believe there is I cannot point, because this statute has not been interpreted that specifically yet by any court. I cannot tell you that there are a set of qualifications or characteristics that must be present. I can tell you that the Ludwig case, which has been referred to substantially within these briefings, laid out some characteristics that it believed that the annuity in that case did not have that it should have. Those are non-assignability provisions for the most part in that case. But there are characteristics that ERISA qualified and tax qualified plans have that this retirement obligation does not have.
Okay, but isn't that just another way of saying that this isn't a tax or ERISA qualified plan?
Yes.
Okay, well, that gets me back to my question. If you're saying that the statute only applies to tax or ERISA qualified plans, I understand that argument. If you're saying that the statute is broader, but it still wasn't satisfied here, you're not, I don't think, telling Judge Daly or Judge Casebolt or me what exactly has to be in a retirement plan that isn't already addressed in the criteria for tax and ERISA qualification.
Well, Your Honor, hopefully this answers it. There may not be any qualifications that are not already in ERISA or tax qualified plans. The point that I would like to come here to make is really what Mr. Ellerton has attempted to do, is to hide assets so that he can preserve a high standard of living. And his main point is, well, I've called this a retirement plan. Even though it's not tax or ERISA qualified, it doesn't share characteristics of this, it is exempt because I call it a retirement plan, and my employer calls it a retirement plan. And I'd like your honors to think about mischief that can be done if Mr. Ellerton's argument about the interpretation of this statute is accepted. Any corporate executive can go to his employer when it looks like he may be sued for past due loans, say, why don't you do this? Just pay me a dollar, we'll call the rest of my salary retirement, and proof it's exempt.
There. Well, I mean, isn't it a little more subtle than that, though? Retirement has a common sense meaning. You perform diligent service through a certain date, then you leave, and you get a retirement bonus. Fair?
Yes.
Okay, well, why wouldn't the statute be interpreted to avoid an absurd result as saying, yes, you have to, there's a contingent obligation on the employer. It vests in the employee after a passage of time. And that typically coincides with age 62, age 65.
Because, Your Honor, as the Ludwig case decided, the way the statute is written, under principles of contract interpretation, the word retirement, obviously there must be a distinction between just earnings and retirement.
But you said it better than I did.
And the Ludwig court found, we're urging you to follow the Ludwig case, Ludwig cases decision-making process, that when the legislature wrote retirement and said including ERISA and tax-qualified plans, through statutory construction principles, the word retirement must be interpreted according to those tax-qualified and ERISA-qualified plans.
Doesn't that assume, or doesn't your argument assume that the term retirement is ambiguous?
In the context of this statute, it does appear that the term retirement is ambiguous and must be interpreted further.
Why exactly is the, I think the phrase in the statute actually is, quote, retirement plan, close quote.
I believe that's correct.
Okay, tell me why exactly that phrase is ambiguous before we get to the including clause that might resolve any ambiguity.
Your Honor, that phrase is ambiguous, first of all, because it's not defined.
Don't we have many cases that hold statutes survive an ambiguity challenge because of a term or phrase has a common sense meaning even though the legislature doesn't define it?
I believe there may be cases like that. I've not read one recently to prepare for this, but I'm sure Your Honor is correct. There probably are cases like that. In this case, however, what these facts of this case bring to light is that term can be ambiguous if you have someone who's claiming that this is a retirement obligation, I intend to use it for my retirement, and therefore it's retirement under this statute. But it is not a situation where it is what most people receive and think of as a retirement plan. It is not ERISA qualified. It is not something that people put money into over time and has certain tax benefits associated with that. It is not a common retirement plan. This is just a situation where Mr. Ellerton, as president, went to SEPTA and said, give me a large chunk of money at a certain period of time, and we'll layer that change to when a specific event happens. And he calls that a retirement plan. The term retirement is ambiguous in this context because it doesn't indicate, is that plan really a retirement plan? It's not. It's just simply an attempt to hide assets.
But why does that make the term ambiguous as opposed to suggesting, although the lower court disagreed, that Mr. Ellerton didn't show that, in fact, there was a bona fide retirement plan at issue?
Your Honor, I will answer questions as quickly as I can. It makes the term ambiguous because there is now a dispute about whether or not when someone simply calls a retirement plan, I intend to use this for my retirement, does that mean it is a retirement under the constructs of the statute, which refers to retirement and then refers to a series of commonly accepted retirement plans that most of us would recognize as retirement. Your Honor, I would like to reserve the remainder of what I have for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good May it please the court and counsel, my name is Dennis Polk. It's P-O-L-K. My attorney registration number is 8777. I represent Mr. Ellerton, and we represented him in the issue with regard to the writ of execution and garnishment. We did not participate in the underlying trial. However, I think the question that the court has focused on is the statute says what the statute says. I don't think it is a magical interpretation. I think the word of subsection S of 1354-102 is clear. Property, including funds held in or payable from, in the word, any pension or retirement plan or deferred compensation plan. I respectfully submit that under the facts of this case and the employment agreement, those funds that are at issue in this, and be they in the form of the stock, are not available to Mr. Ellerton. In my reading of these facts, until his employment ceases, and I think then we simply apply the common ordinary understanding of the term retirement.
But at what date, what would be his calendar age when he could claim the benefits by leaving the company?
Well, I think the employment agreement doesn't speak to that, Your Honor. I think that it is anticipated by these parties that he is going to retire not older than 72 years of age.
Was there testimony, I realize the agreement might not state his age, was there testimony as to what age he would be when these benefits would be vested?
I don't believe there is anything in the record that addresses that question, Your Honor.
During the term of the employment agreement, did he continue to receive a regular salary in addition to this retirement fund that would become vested at a time in the future?
He was paid when funds were available for his labor and services. Sefton did not always have funds to pay him, but he was paid for his work and labor.
Is there any indication in the record that portion of was withheld assisted funding this retirement?
I don't think that is the case, Your Honor.
Is there any indication in the record that other employees, high-level employees, vice president, secretary, treasurer, etc., had a similar plan?
The record shows, and both in the form of the annual statements and I believe the testimony in the Rule 6-9, that there were three or four other employees that had like or similar types of pension or retirement plans or benefits. It was not unique to Mr. Ellerton.
So my follow-up question then is, those plans could not be tax qualified, could they, because they would provide payment to highly compensated employees?
I don't believe that they are tax qualified plans.
Do you read the statute to say tax qualified plans or what?
No, I don't, Your Honor.
What do you read it?
I believe that the use of the phrase in subsection S of 102, following the antecedent phrase, any pension or retirement plan, and then the description, including those in which the debtor has received benefits or payments, has the present right to receive benefits or payments, or has the right to receive benefits or payments in the future, and including pensions or plans which qualify under ERISA tax qualified. Those are words in normal statutory construction of not of limitation. And I don't think they can be read as words of limitation. If the legislature had meant to say only those plans that are tax qualified or ERISA qualified plans are exempt, it could have said so. And that's not what it says. As we've gone through the legislative history in this, the legislature has looked at this. There have been very few court decisions with regard to this. The bankruptcy decision the council relies upon, I don't believe, supports their position. And that decision, and I think you have to look at it, it is unique to its facts, because what we're really talking about is an annuity that the bankruptcy debtor or bankrupt party obtained by using tax, or not tax, but using a stock purchase money that they had under their prior employment, converted to cash and then bought something else and then said it was his intent that that be a qualified plan. Here, this is so factually different because we have a board of directors that is involved in the overview supervision of this plan. We have an employment agreement, and it is called in those terms a pensioner type of plan or benefit. I don't think it is determinative whether it's ERISA or tax-based.
Let me ask you this. What would be the purpose of adding those tax-qualified and ERISA-type plans? Why not just say any retirement or pension plan?
Well, I think that there was an issue that arose in 1988 as a result, as my understanding of legislative history, that caused a determination to add those provisions. And I think that language was added as opposed to words of contraction. And I think it was done to address a specific finding, as best that I can determine, of a bankruptcy court that had determined that some aspects of the prior statute were unconstitutional. And I think it was to address that is the only reason I can find.
So let me ask you this, is essentially adding those terms, are those in essence intended to be a limitation upon the types of plans that are contemplated such that the statute would no longer be unconstitutional?
I don't think that that was the intent. I think it was to add to that, to address those issues, to make specifically these types of plans exempt. I think the issue was the converse, that they were not specifically articulated before, and it goes back to the fact that ERISA preempts state law on these issues. And because they were federally preempted under ERISA, that is the basis for their inclusion here, Your Honor, as opposed to words of limitation. And I think it's that issue that we're addressing. I respectfully submit, Your Honor, that the trial court, as the court pointed out in its order, perhaps could have been more explicit in its factual findings, but I think the trial court's factual findings are sufficient to establish that the court determined the issues that you had raised, because it finds that this plan is qualified under the plain reading of this statute.
Lower court, did Mr. Dillaball specifically argue that the statute was ambiguous and that it should be interpreted as including only tax and ERISA qualified plans?
Your Honor, I apologize. I don't recall degree of specificity. I apologize. I don't know that it was articulated. I think the primary focus in the lower court was the application of the Ludwig decision. We'd ask that the trial court be affirmed in this matter, and this matter be remanded back for that determination.
Colt, before you finish, let me ask you a question. There's been a focus on the word retirement, but we also have to look at plan because that's part of the statutory language. What does plan mean in this context? Does plan mean one single agreement benefiting one single individual? Or does it mean comprehensive plan that covers all employees, or what does it mean?
Well, I think that it means a determination of a form of benefit that is payable to somebody when they reach retirement. And that's all I think it requires. But here there was, in fact, in the record here, a plan that benefited more than Mr. Ellerton. I could envision a circumstance where one person could be benefited. For example, you had a retirement plan and you had a single member LLC or something like that. So I could envision a circumstance where only one person was benefited. But here, that's not the facts that we're faced with. We had highly compensated, so to speak, executives, more than Mr. Ellerton, who had a benefit. So I think that that is a plan. I think there's nothing magical about the use of the word plan. Thank you, Your Honors.
Did Your Honor have a question? That
yes. Did for the lower court, did you specifically argue that the statute was ambiguous and should be interpreted based on ERISA tax qualified plans?
Your Honor, we did not argue that the, we argued the statute was ambiguous, but not that it should be only ERISA and tax-qualified plans. We argued that it should be only ERISA tax-qualified plans and retirement plans that are substantially similar to those plans, similar to what the Ludwig decision decided. Your Honor, very briefly, retirement must and earnings must be differentiated, and the way the legislature intended for those to be differentiated is they must be ERISA-qualified, tax-qualified, or substantially similar plans. That's the purpose of the language in the statute. We urge you to follow the reasoning of the Ludwig Court. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. Case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.